Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com, for faith, fellowship, and love. CMF Curo is the country's first Catholic healthcare ministry to provide an affordable health-sharing solution rooted in Catholic teaching and community. Learn more at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com. CMF Curo, healthcare fully alive.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface, my fellow truth seekers, here at WCAP Radio 980 on your dial as well as mine. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets, attempting to bring a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Glad you could join us tonight. We are here from 10 to 11 every Monday night, as we are tonight. And delving beneath the surface on a question that is important to the human condition. So if you are human, these beneath the surface questions apply to you. Tonight, ladies and gentle things, we delve beneath the surface on the question of confession. The question or the issue or the topic of confession. What is meant by confession? And why is it so important to the human psyche? Why is it so important to our psychological and emotional state? So we're going to talk about this from not only a religious point of view, but from a psychological point of view and a relational point of view. And we hope that you give us a call sometime tonight to join in our conversation. Give us your 2 cents, if you will. And I tell you what, if you want to change the topic, as long as it's a reasonable topic, we are as open as can be. Our phone number is 978-454-4980, 978-454-4980. I'm Paul Morano, and let me introduce to you my not one, not three, but 2 guests tonight. That's right. Your favorite guests and mine, minus one, are here tonight. Left to right in your radio, Mr. Robert LeBlanc. Robert is a what? Fill in the blank.
I am, I guess, in the teacher mode. I just came in from teaching some young Catholic children about the faith.
Oh. Indeed. So.
Am I on there?
Teacher, philosopher, an all-around good guy. Extraordinaire Mr. Robert LeBlanc.
Well, I have something to confess, Paul.
Ooh, on the day that we talk about confession, you want to confess something?
Yes.
Ah, please
I
do.
I think I'm going to have a lot of fun with this show.
That's, I like that confession, and I hope it's true. Okay, so to your left, to my right, and to their imaginational whatever, is Mr., the one, the only, the exquisite, the unmentionable, the absolute, Mr. John Tudorus.
I agree with everything except the exquisite.
Oh, you're not all that exquisite.
No. Very common indeed I am.
Okay. Common you are. You commoner. 978-454-4980. If you want to get on beneath the surface as we continue, or at least begin and then continue, our discussion. All right. Gentlemen.
Where?
That's a good question. Tonight we talk about confession. Let's see, where do we start? All right, I'll tell you what. Let me just start to throw out a general question. Confess what?
Sin.
Sin. I affirm his answer.
You affirm that answer. All right. So, for those who don't believe in sin, what is sin? There's an objective part of sin, and there's a subjective part of sin. Who wants to do the objective first?
I'm not sure what you mean by objective, but I'm going to take this for a stab of an answer.
You do that.
I think the objective that you're referring to is a separation between you as a person and between you and God. That is what.
That's more the subjective.
That is more the subjective.
Yeah, right. I guess that could be seen as objective too, but the objective part of sin is to miss the mark.
Okay.
And the question is, what mark? What mark are we talking about? Well, the mark that right reason can detect, that which is against reason, is missing the mark, and hence any behavior that violates reason and human nature would be sin. Yes.
More specifically, I would say behavior that violates the good.
Yeah. Yeah, the good, which reason can detect.
Yes.
By virtue of understanding ourselves as to what the goods are in order to fulfill our being. And so that would be the objective part of what we need to confess when we intentionally break that. The subjective part has to do with the relational part, doesn't it?
Sure.
Yeah.
But you're talking about like the as far as people as subjects.
Yes, and God is maybe a subject.
Yeah, yeah. The relational part,
right.
that doing something wrong can harm, or even if it's bad enough, destroy a relationship.
I'd like to jump into that.
Please jump.
Yeah. I think one of the ways to look at it is not really just between God and I, but to relate it to between humans and humans, between friends or possibly between two married people,
okay.
A man and a wife. When you sin against that person, when you've done some wrong to that person, you've harmed that relationship between the two of you, and what you should want to do, what a normal, ordinary person should want to do, once they realize that they've hurt the other or done something to the relationship to harm that relationship, they want to say, "I'm sorry."
Mm-hmm.
And they want to offer some sort of penance or sign of
restitution.
Flowers, chocolates, promises you don't intend to keep.
Or doing their lawn or cooking or washing. Or
make it up to them in some way.
Make it up to them in some way.
Cooking. Unless you're a bad cook, then that would be a bad form of restitution.
Now, a lot of people would say, well, we're human. We all make mistakes. Gentlemen, tell me the difference between a mistake and a sin.
Ooh.
And if you don't tell me the right answer, I'll give it.
Oh, well, let me give a stab at it. Or does John want to give a stab at it?
No,
all right.
You first.
So a mistake is when you make an error, but it has no moral component to it.
What gives something a moral component?
If I said 1 + 1 = 3, I've made an error. But I've not sinned. I've not made a moral error in that case.
Well, suppose you choose a human behavior, something that is morally bad objectively, but you're not aware of it. You're invincibly ignorant at the time. Is that a mistake or an error, or is it a sin?
Well, I would say it's still a sin. There's still an objective thing that's applied here. I think what you would be affecting is the moral culpability of the act, whether the person is personally responsible for that act or not. If he's ignorant that this is wrong, and truly so, then you would say, okay, well, he's done a sin. But he's not completely responsible.
But if
for
he's
that
not
sin.
Guilty, couldn't you just say he's committed a moral error, but it isn't necessarily a sin because he didn't know that it was wrong at the time?
Well, I guess I would argue against the premise there. There is such a thing as I guess, some sort of, what is the word I'm looking for? Invincible ignorance.
Yeah.
I would say is possible, but we as human beings, we as St. Paul says, we have the law written in our hearts. And I think there's a component that you should know that certain acts or behaviors are wrong, ordinarily.
But you do agree that there are some situations in life, especially perhaps when you're a little more immature.
Okay.
That's
a child or something.
No, I'm not even talking a child.
Okay.
I'm talking about somebody who's reached the age of reason.
Okay.
Say somebody in their 20s. Was brought up a certain way, completely enculturated a certain way, and did an act believing that it was okay, it was morally okay because his parents did it, his siblings did it, he didn't know any difference, didn't know an alternative, and then 5 years later he looks back and just like bangs his head and said, I just can't believe I was that dumb and I did that.
Mm-hmm.
I was so brainwashed. But at the time he did the act, he didn't know it was wrong. Is that, we can say objectively that's a moral error, and even a moral evil.
Uh-huh.
But is one culpable for sin, and should we use the word sin?
I think, by your original definition, you know, missing the mark, it still is a sin. Otherwise, you'd have to change your definition. But I think we're just really in the area of whether a person is culpable for it or not. The objective thing there is still there.
It's still a moral evil.
It's still a moral evil.
Yeah, it is. It is. It disrupts the moral order.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is the last time I'll ask it. Should we use the word sin when the person who disrupts the moral order with their action is not culpable because of invincible ignorance?
I think we should.
Okay.
I think we should.
John, your thoughts?
I think I would tend to agree with Bob. But it would require some soul searching. Because one of the things that's important as far as understanding whether or not we've committed violations of the moral order,
yeah,
in our will and our desire is to actually inform our conscience. So there's a certain amount of right and wrong that's written into the human person. It's part of natural law to understand things.
And you're about to say that, and we have an obligation to form our consciences according to that,
to
the objective true and good.
So you mentioned before invincible ignorance. Now,
yeah,
that's where, so invincible just means that there's no way that they could have known more. But nowadays, it's actually most people to one degree or another have the capability to do so. You know, it's just maybe due to sloth or what have you. I mean, you can go online and anything you want, you can look up. If someone doesn't know if this or that is a sin, I mean, you can just look it up. You can say, I can go to some search engine on some website and just punch in a few keywords, and I can find all the catechism passages that talk about, for example, sin, what's venial, what's mortal. And
do you need to begin with that relationship with God to even care about whether something is a sin or not?
You do. And so I would say that the responsibility is
ancient,
but I wouldn't say it's invincible.
But why? I mean, like we said earlier, sin does three things, or at least we alluded to it. It does offend God, but even for the non-religious, it does the other two things. It harms others and hurts self.
Oh, yes.
So right reason can see certain behaviors harm others and hurt self, even if you don't have the extra religious, the most important part, that it offends God. So then why must one have a relationship with God in order to recognize what reason can see?
Well, for one thing, reason, the conformity of the mind to reality is contingent upon that uncaused cause. That makes the universe, the world, intelligible.
You don't necessarily have to be cognizant or aware of that uncaused cause, do you, in order to see things
reason? But, I mean, the general frame of mind is that one has to desire to pursue what is true, regardless of whether or not...
You have to desire it.
Exactly. Whether or not they find themselves in that true position.
So you have to love truth in order to care about truth. Sometimes in order to even see it. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I mean, you take a character like Socrates, right? I mean, here he is in ancient Greece, and he lived in a very pagan culture where politics then was like politics now. You get lying politicians with all the rhetoric.
Yeah.
And wanting to cut through all that, he wanted to know what the truth was. And so much so that it actually brought him to his death. He loved truth more than his own life.
Yes. Now, I suppose, Bob, that's the point where everyone should be. Loving truth more than your very self.
Yes. I'm hearing the music.
Don't worry about it.
So
speak over it.
So, yes, I think that's a perspective of humility, which Socrates has. And it's a right ordering. Sometimes it's not merely the fact that you know the truth. You may have a whole collection of truths, but knowing the order of truths, what is more important? And Socrates saw the truth as more important than himself, which is a pretty enlightened, in the sense, I think, of Christianity being the light, is a very important thing.
Can you care about yourself and others, and of course sin harms both, can you truly, on any kind of significant level, care about yourself and or others without a right relationship with God?
I find it difficult to do, although I suppose I'm open to the possibility that a person might be able to be there and be able to respect the truth. Obviously, we have in the example of Socrates.
Mm.
Socrates did believe in God, but he didn't believe in the Jewish or Christian God.
After this break, we're going to talk about the problem that we have in modern times about people not believing there is an objective good or truth relating to human nature. And if there is no objective good or truth, then sin becomes meaningless and confession absolutely unnecessary. 978-454-4980. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. I'm Paul Morano, and my guests tonight are Bob LeBlanc and John Tudoris. Be back right after this. And we are back. We are back. 978-454-4980 is our phone number here at WCAP. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. I'm Paul Morano, your host, as always. Gentlemen, this is show number 185 of Beneath the Surface Lore.
Ooh. 15 more before the 200.
Wow, yes. That's what I was thinking.
Yes.
Hot diggity dog.
Now, we've been doing Beneath the Surface Radio here at WCAP since February of 2013. And we've been doing Beneath the Surface Television at Burlington Cable Access Television since 2003, summer of 2003.
Well, we kind of joined a little later in the journey.
Yeah, you joined a little later.
I don't think we met you until maybe 2006?
Yeah.
Wow, it's been a very long time, Paul.
Yeah. I've known you guys for a dozen years.
Yeah, the first question I got out of you was, is there humor in heaven? I think that was the question.
Oh, that's funny.
Do people laugh? I remember that, yes.
Yeah. Gosh, we should do a whole show on that.
Yeah, does God laugh?
Do angels and saints laugh?
Hmm.
And why would they need to laugh if there are no foibles, if everything is perfect?
You know, you reminded me of a great Chesterton quote and I'll try to paraphrase it. It's very difficult, but I'll try to paraphrase it. Chesterton, at the end of The Everlasting Man, or maybe it's Orthodoxy, talks about the great Christian spirit. And he talks about it, something that God... Can you hear me?
Okay, now I can, yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Something that Jesus hid during his entire time in the gospel, and what Jesus hid, and what's the great secret of Christianity, was Jesus' mirth, his mirth, his, okay. his joy, his happiness, his
Wait. Joy and happiness are much different than humor.
Mirth has a sense of laughter.
But will there be mirth along with the infinite joy and happiness if everything is perfect?
I think there will be.
Okay,
yes.
Another show. But another show. That's a foretaste.
A foretaste
of another show. 978-454-4980. Our show tonight is on the topic of confession. Before we get to Cindy's question, Cindy came in here and asked a very good question about confession, challenging the whole notion of confession. I want to get to that in a few minutes, but I just want to finish our thoughts before the break. And that is, gentlemen, if you're brought up in a post-Christian, you know, postmodern, I guess, culture like the United States of America in the 21st century, and you are taught that there is no objective truth or goodness, that we sort of construct it as either individuals or cultures, as we, and redefine it as we go along, then can you be sorry about anything? Is the notion of confession worthless?
Well, given their premises, the answer would be yes.
It would be worthless.
It would be worthless.
I would say not entirely.
Well, you would have to go back into an objective truth in order to respond to that.
Well, nature abhors a vacuum, though, so even if they reject the idea of confession in its more perfect form, they still adhere to it in lesser forms. To give you an example,
okay.
We look at the world's very first autobiography, St. Augustine's Confessions from the 300s.
That's not postmodern.
But that's a benchmark. So that type of confession that he has in there, it's not with all the sordid details. Really what he does is he gets at the essence of who he was before he changed, and then who he was after the change.
Okay.
Whereas now, if you get a tell-all book, an autobiography, it's got all the sordid details, and it's not for the purpose of communicating the essence of something, what is really true. Rather, it's more like saying, look at me, look at all these things that I've done, and then that's it.
But I think you're proving the point, and the question is, these people who write these books, they're not sorry. Usually, they're not sorry for what they did.
And if you look at
all these sexual assaulters now that are coming out by the dozens, they're not. It doesn't seem like they're actually sorry. It's just that they got caught and they need to appear like they're sorry. So if you lose the sense of sin, how can you be sorry and want to confess anything other than your, what you define as sin for yourself? And usually that means that for yourself, bad, selfish acts are not sinful.
Well, I think we're if we're going to go with what John was saying here, is I think we need to point out that human beings are complex, irrational creatures at times. I mean, we like to say that to be a human being is to be a rational animal. But the fact is, especially with this postmodern idea of moral relativity, yeah, it's philosophically incomplete, incorrect. It kind of refutes itself.
But it seems, Bob, that people are only sorry, and it's not a heartfelt sorrow usually. It's a politically correct sorrow that I've been caught,
yeah,
about what is popular and politically correct at the time, not what, yeah, is objectively right or wrong.
There's a certain sort of denial that's going on in here. As St. Paul writes, and I think this is an objective truth, and in fact, if I tried to express against this truth, people would definitely say I'm wrong. So, St. Paul says that the law, God's law, or the law, natural law, is written in everyone's heart.
Right.
It's in there by design, yep, by our nature. We know these sorts of things. And if I were to say only Christians know the difference between right and wrong, good and evil, I'm almost guaranteed that people are going to step up and be contrary to me and say, no, we know what good and evil is.
Okay.
They would be very strong about that. But how would they do that? What would their moral basis be to say that if they say everything is just relative? It may be just right and wrong for Christians.
It's a contradiction.
It's a contradiction. And, yeah. And eventually people who believe in this moral relativism are living in this kind of contradiction. They're in their mind,
yeah.
They're holding these two contrary thoughts, and you see it all the time. One yeah. of the great sins in this postmodern age is racism. Mm. But if morality is merely relative, then you can't really say that this is a great evil.
You can't.
Racism might be okay in yeah. America. It may be wrong in Germany, but it might be okay in America. Now, I'm not saying that this is true. I'm just saying, how can you hold that this yeah. is an absolute moral wrong?
Right, you can't. Moral relativism is certainly based on a contradiction. They try to uphold human rights without recognizing that human rights are objective and universal for everybody, and not simply relative.
Yes, and at that point, when you violate somebody's rights, and I guess you could like reformulate this idea of sin in terms of human rights. If you're violating a person's human dignity.
Yeah.
Then you are committing a sin against that person. And in fact, and they may not believe it, but you can even sin against yourself.
What if, let's get into the self in a second, but what if the other person consents?
Yes. Well, let's ask the question whether they could consent to slavery.
All right, let's ask it.
What if
a person consents to slavery, so you enslave them?
Right, then you
is
would
that
be,
is that a moral evil?
And then you would have to admit, if you say it's not a moral evil, if they consented to that, then you would have to say that slavery is not intrinsically an evil.
Hmm.
You couldn't say, you know, this is truly an evil thing to have slavery, because you could come up with an exception. Well, if they consent to slavery, then slavery must be okay in that case.
Right, so that's another contradiction.
Right.
Isn't it interesting how it seems like the areas of sexuality in human life are the only places where there is there seems to be legitimate or illegitimate contradiction involved?
Well, I think the sexual sins are not like the top mortal sins or grave sins on the very, very top. St. Thomas Aquinas recognizes that they are a result of the appetites, the passions, they signal a sort
unless
of weakness.
Unless they're willful.
Yeah. Those are not really sins of malice.
Right.
Usually.
Yeah.
But as soon as you start opening the door for these sexual sins, you start, I guess, running into problems. I was just watching a little snippet of a movie today, and it seems like everybody is very open about their sexuality. But if you notice, like, if two people are dating,
yeah.
if one person has sexual intimacy with someone else outside of the relationship, that seems to be a great sin in today's culture. You can't cheat on your not married relationship.
Right, right. Oh, I know how the blindness
yeah,
works
the
contradiction.
It seems to be, they still seem to have that natural law kind of still built in there.
That longing for fidelity.
Yes, they want.
Even though you can cheat on your future spouse as much as you want beforehand.
Right.
That semblance of or that trace of that desire for fidelity
right.
still is there, even though it's all distorted.
Yeah, I think they call it serial monogamy.
Serial monogamy. Right. Exactly.
Right, but it's I guess. A different way of looking at bigamy, I suppose.
It is. I think that
you're doing it. You're not marrying once in your lifetime. You're marrying several times.
Or at least you're in a marital-like state.
In a marital-like state. That is a very good way to put it.
When you become one flesh with somebody else. We should do a whole show on that. The notion of becoming one flesh as a permanent act rather than simply a temporary thing that you do, as moderns tend to look at it. John. You awake?
I certainly am.
By the way, I do have Bob and John in the studio tonight. John, speaking of the ancients, why don't you tell us some of the traces of how ancient people and postmodern people in general have confessed and tried to cleanse themselves of their own sins in, say, history?
Sure, I can do that. And just real briefly, too, to add to the the side of sidebar comment, you can almost boil it down if people want to think of a difference in thought. Truth is not seen now in the modern mind as the conformity of the mind to reality.
Correct.
Rather, it's the appropriating of reality
to the mind.
To the mind. And, of course, what do we know? I mean, that's not the way we're built.
I know.
I mean, authentic science, for example, where our reason is used to come to greater knowledge of things, the only way for that to work effectively is to actually check our ego at the door and then conform the mind to what is real. So that's one point. The other is the consequence of that gets to which, and this is something I've heard you mention before, too, is that feelings rule the day.
Today.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Feelings rule the day. That gets to the point you mentioned before. And because the feelings are more important of the person, the appetites and the passions are ruling rather than
the mind.
The reason and the mind and the will.
That's right. So, in other words, we're acting more like animals and less like the human beings that we're supposed to be.
Exactly.
Rational animal.
Exactly.
All right.
So that's one. Now,
yes, Mr. John.
And now to the ancients.
Yes. Or at least the pre-moderns.
The pre-moderns. And actually, we'll even go a little beyond that, a few thousand years. So, for example.
I'm all ears.
So, ancient Israel. All right. So, everyone's heard the term of, that person's a scapegoat, right?
Yes.
It's like their sins are put on. Well, that's a practice in the ancient world whereby, symbolically, you would have a goat. And it would be sent off in the desert, and symbolically that goat would be carrying the sins of...
So the community places their sins on this animal, this goat, and then leads that goat out of the community. They shut the gates. The animal presumably dies in the desert, and with that death of the goat is the death of their sins.
Yes, and it's symbolic only, but just this idea that their sins need some sort of atonement.
This is very interesting, is it not?
It is, and it's not just ancient Israel. I mean, you look at, of course, that's been adopted by Jews now.
But what is it a prefigurement of, ultimately?
Well, ultimately, that's a prefigurement of course, what comes about in Christianity. That there's this idea of not just a symbolic forgiveness of sins. For example, there was one temple in ancient Israel and where they would sacrifice animals, and depending upon the severity of sin, there might be a greater sacrifice, which may cost more.
Right.
But even then, they recognized that there was no true atonement for sins. It was only symbolic.
Or it was at least prefiguring what was to come.
Exactly.
And by the way, Jews weren't the only ones. This was a universal phenomenon.
That's correct.
That people not only sacrificed animals continuously to try to atone for their sins and cleanse themselves of their sin, but many, unfortunately, even of ancient times, sacrificed humans.
Oh, yes, they did.
In order to do this, to placate their gods, to become right with their gods again. Bob.
Well, there's a guy I found about recently. He was a French Catholic philosopher who recently passed away. And unfortunately, I had to find out about him because he passed away. He was a philosopher, and he developed this idea, and he realized this was universal. This need for a scapegoat is a universal
phenomena
for all. And his name was René Guigard.
Yep.
We got to have a show about him someday. About this universality.
Scapegoating, yes,
We see it more recently in Nazi Germany, the rise of Nazi Germany, where the Jews collectively were seen as the scapegoat for all of Germany's problems.
Yes.
Everything was put on them, and so what you need to do, if that person becomes a scapegoat, or that people become a scapegoat, is to put all... everything on them, and harm them. And so it's a universal of society I guess, rather than just merely a Jewish and Christian sort of thing.
When we get back from this break, we have waited long enough. We are going to hear Cindy's question that she asked us during the last break about confession, and I think it's going to be a question that a lot of our listeners can relate to, because they're probably asking the same one about this notion of confession. So right after this break, we'll hear from our producer, Cindy, from Cindy's Vinyl Vault, which happens to be right after this show, as well as a couple of other nights. Stay tuned. We'll be right back right after this break. Is the BTS hotline. 976-454-4980. You can get in a phone call if you're interested before 11 o'clock. So give us a call soon. Our topic tonight on Beneath the Surface is confession. We've been talking a lot about the preliminaries for talking about confession head on. And our producer, Cindy, came in the studio a little while ago to ask us, ask us a question relating to the necessity of confession. So, Cindy, what was it that you had said to us?
So, my question is, you know, if you go into your room at night before you go to bed and pray and say, "I'm sorry, God," then why do you have to go to confession if you just said sorry to him?
Okay, so, gentlemen, God is everywhere. He's certainly in bedrooms. So if you pray quietly, you shut the door, you pray quietly, and you confess your sins privately, why isn't that enough?
I'll give an analogy to help perhaps illustrate that. So let's say you have a man and a woman, and they're preparing for marriage.
All right.
And they go through, and they have this intention to marry, and they go through and they practice, and they even say these words, and they want it to happen. But until they actually go through the ceremony and actually get married and exchange those vows, the marriage doesn't happen. So bringing that up is because confession itself is actually the vehicle by which that forgiveness happens. So when someone in their private prayer expresses sorrow and contrition for their sins
to God,
right,
yeah,
that disposes them towards confession, but it is not in itself the act of confession in its fullness. So it would not be the actual sacrament, which is a material means by which grace is given.
But why do you need a sacrament with the ritual of sacraments in order to be officially forgiven by God, Bob?
Well, here's what I hope I was right. This is what I said to a child tonight who asked about confession. Can a person confess to God privately and be forgiven?
Yeah.
And my answer is, yes, that's possible. God is not required to act within the sacrament. So it's possible, but you don't really know if you've actually provided the right amount of contrition and sorrow for that sin.
Right.
I don't, especially in our fallen state, I don't think we realize if we've really truly regretted that sin. In fact, there are some sins that I've done where I think I sense some sort of pleasure from those sorts of sins, you know.
So what?
And well, when you confess those sins, did I really have true contrition for doing that sin?
Yeah.
And with confession, what you have is you just need some sort of contrition for it. You don't need a perfect contrition for the sins, a perfect sorrow for the sins.
Okay.
Whatever you have there, God is willing to take that and operate with that in the sacrament and make up for what is lacking that in your sorrowfulness for that sin. And so what I would say is that confession is necessary in the normal sense because we can't be truly sure if we've actually done our entire part as far as offering contrition and then actually coming up with some sort of penance to do that. And that's usually what the priest offers in there. There's some sort of recompense or something that to pay back for the sins that we've done. Even though it is a token offering, it is there in action. We're giving flowers, we're cooking the meal or whatever to God, mm-hmm. as we talked about earlier in a relationship. And there's also this. We actually get to hear the words of absolution from the priest, and the priest is speaking in the name of God. And he says, I absolve you in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And therefore, you know that right. you've been forgiven.
There right. is so in other words,
communication that's
in
happening.
That, in that moment, the priest takes the place of Christ himself.
He's acting in the person of Christ.
And that's the sacramental part of this.
Right. And in fact, I think in each of these in each of the sacraments, you are encountering Christ. You are there
right.
with the living God.
Right. And that isn't the case if you confess privately.
Right.
It doesn't have that sacramental sign.
You don't know. Yes.
Before I get to you, John, let me just add a couple of things to that. Number one, I think, John, you kind of alluded to it earlier. The one answer to the question as to why you need to go to confession rather than simply confess privately is because Jesus said so.
Exactly. And that actually leads to the points that Bob was making about the assurities that we can have. That actually comes from that. We get the priests get their powers to dispense these graces through the sacraments because there is a direct connection through history all the way to the apostles who receive those powers from Jesus directly.
So then Jesus established it. He's the one that said, basically, you must, without saying it in these words, paraphrasing, you must go to confession. Whosoever sins you forgive shall be forgiven them, when he ordained his 12 apostles and their successors. So these ordained people have that power of God, that power from God. So since God is the only one who can forgive, if God gives that particular power to forgive sins to certain people, then they too have that power.
That is yes. correct.
So those ordained people we call priests and or bishops have that power from Christ as being another Christ in that moment of literally absolving you and cleansing you of those sins.
And there's probably something I hope we don't forget is the fact that when we do go to confession, not only do we restore ourselves in that sanctifying grace, but we also receive grace to help us resist sin in the
future. Yeah, exactly.
And the more you do this, the more you gain in virtue. So you actually become much more holy by going to confession, confessing your sins to another person, mainly the priest.
Yeah.
And I think there's where you get kind of the psychological thing, because you're actually confessing this not to a God that you cannot see in your bedroom in the moment, but actually you're saying it to a very, very real person. And in fact, we can't confess over the phone or by computer.
Right.
We actually
right.
have to be in the same place that the priest is at.
So perhaps this personal relationship, dialogue, encounter is why Christ himself established this sacrament as the norm for him through the priest to forgive sins. So number one, Christ established it. It's his will that we do it this way. Number two, there's something that hasn't been said yet. And that is it answers the question, who do we sin against? We talked about this earlier. We sin against God primarily and his church, his extended body. We talked about God and community. We sin against both of those. The priest in that sacramental moment is taking the place of both Christ, who is God, and taking the place or representing his church on earth, both of whom we have offended by our sins. He's that perfect person to take the place of both Christ and church, because he is the representative of both. And so when he, in the name of Christ, forgives and absolves you of your sins, you can know, you can be certain, like you're saying, Bob, that those sins are truly forgiven and you don't have to think about them or feel guilty about them any longer.
You can walk away.
And I'll add to that, too, that these sacramental powers are not contingent upon the holiness of the priest.
That's important.
And that's very, very important.
For all seven sacraments.
That's yeah. correct. So the priests themselves, they're fallible, just like you and I and everyone else in the audience listening. But God is not fallible. And so when he institutes it, so this infallible, this perfect God gives these powers to these fallible people. So God is basically raising them up to this, giving them powers that are beyond their normal nature to dispense this grace from God. And, of course, grace is, again, using lay speak, is God giving us the little extra oomph. To do what we
supernatural
ought to
life, yeah, divine
supernatural
that
life.
Divine life that enables us to live rightly. I have another point relating to this that my mouth was open for. What was it? Oh yes, there are two things. There are two basic things that the ordained priests can do that lay people cannot do, and that is forgive sins in the name of Christ. And change the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. I can't do that. So you could say that the question of why can't I just ask God to forgive me alone in my bedroom could be similar to saying, why can't I just take my bread and wine at my own supper time and lift it up to God and have him change that into his body and blood so I can receive communion? The answer is, we don't have that power as non-ordained Christians. We don't have that power to do that.
Well, even a priest does not have the power to forgive his own sins. A priest actually...
He's given the power.
He's given the power to forgive someone else's sins.
Oh.
But he's not given
the
power to forgive his own sins. What a priest or a bishop has to do is go to another priest or bishop to receive the sacrament of confession or to do the sacrament to receive absolution.
Let me bring Cindy back on. Cindy, we just yakked about your question for about 10 or 15 minutes. Do you have any thoughts about it?
Thanks for answering it. And, it makes it easier to understand and to understand why I actually need to do this.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. A lot of people think, like Cindy had thought about the sacrament of confession, that it's expendable, that it's not necessary. I don't think Jesus thought that, or else he wouldn't have established it for everybody.
Yeah, I think that we didn't go into the psychological aspect of deeply.
To me, that's secondary to the authority of Christ.
Right, absolutely.
But there's
something, I can only express this subjectively, how I've experienced a confession. When I've sinned, when I've done something wrong, it's like there's a cloud that's following me. You know, over my head, there's a dark cloud. Everything seems very dark and black. Or even, you know, you wake up, it's a gray day, you just don't want to do anything. You've lost all sort of life within yourself.
Yes.
And I go to confession, and this happens about 75% of the time. I experience this subjectively. I go into confession, I try to do the best confession I do, I walk out, and it feels like I'm walking on air.
Yes.
I've lightened the load.
I'm mixing metaphors,
but there's this feeling like, wow, I feel so great. There is this kind of thing where, one, I've let go of that sin. I no longer have to worry about that sin, but the fact of
you're
from
free.
The absolute, I'm free.
Yes,
there is a
free.
Freeing feeling that comes from confession.
I think a lot of people feel that darkness and heaviness that you were talking about without realizing it because they haven't articulated in their mind with any kind of faith that they have sinned. And so I think even subconsciously people are walking around with that feeling that don't know the wonderful freedom that comes from the sacrament of confession.
They may try to distract themselves by watching a lot of TV or maybe medicate themselves with alcohol or drugs or something like that.
Now, speaking of metaphors, confession is like a spiritual shower.
Yes, absolutely.
You could say that baptism is a spiritual bath, but confession is a spiritual shower. I tell my kids sometimes, how long would you take without taking a physical shower? And just think of how dirty, and dirt, of course, is a metaphor, but how dirty the soul can get if you don't take a spiritual shower in the sacrament of confession. And I find that many confessionals are sort of shaped like a shower stall. Yeah. And that grace from God is sort of right through the mouth of the priest. It's coming right at you, like in the form of water. But anyway, gentlemen, any last thoughts before we leave on confession?
Well, I say confession is really good for you.
All right.
I will say amen to that. And if you're afraid to go, just go. In fact, that fear itself is a sign that it's better to go.
Amen. So, thank you, Bob LeBlanc, John Tudoris, my guests. I'm Paul Morano. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets. Meet us again here next week, same time, same channel, 10 to 11, Monday nights, WCAT. Thanks for listening, everybody, and have a great, fantastic week.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.